As you may have heard, there are source sheets. If you don't have some, you can move next to someone who has. That's fine. And if not, I'll try to read the sources out loud and carefully, and I hope that everyone will be able to follow. Alma avda ha'aretz. What was it that led to the destruction of the land? What was it that led to the various destructions that have befallen the Jewish people over the years? Much of Jewish literature, from Tanakh on to the present day, tries to answer some of these questions and offer explanations why bad things have happened to the Jewish people. Whenever some calamity befalls the Jewish people, someone invariably stands up and gives an explanation that he or she understands that it is because of the following sin that these bad things have occurred. The desire to explain why bad things happen is totally understandable. The desire to assert and to prove that yesh din v'yesh dayan, that there is judgment in this world and that there is recompense in this world, and that things don't just happen randomly, is also entirely understood. This is not just a Jewish idea. Even Aristotle, when he described how a tragedy had to be composed, said that if a tragic hero did not have any kind of tragic flaw to him, if he was totally good and then terrible things happened to him, then people would not be able to relate to a play like this. It would just be horrific to try to consider the possibility that someone who is totally good was the victim of some terrible, tragic fate. And so while we understand why people offer explanations of this nature, I think that all of us are also understandably angered when we occasionally hear facile and unfeeling and know-it-all explanations for various bad things that happen in our own lifetime. Whether it is the explanation the Jews died in the Shoah because they sinned by becoming Zionists, or for that matter, the Jews died in the Shoah because they sinned by the fact that they did not become Zionists. Either one of these explanations, I think most of the people in this room would be immediately turned off by explanations of this nature. And unfortunately, we know that explanations of this nature are offered on a fairly regular basis. Rabbis in Israel often suggest that some pigua, some terrorist incident, or some bus accident was the result of people having faulty mezuzot on their doors. And explanations of this nature, from my perspective, are making a mockery of religion. And besides the fact that they're reducing mezuzot to the status of amulets or good luck charms. But you might say the contemporary rabbis who offer explanations of this nature are following in a grand tradition. A tradition that began in the Bible and continued in classical rabbinic literature. Chazal are constantly offering explanations why something bad happened. And I'll admit, there is some truth to that claim, that there is precedent to be found for the attempt to find explanations of this nature. In fact, a friend of mine, Professor Daniel Lasker of Ben-Gurion University of the Negev, a trained philosopher, wrote an article recently in which he argued, I know Professor Lasker very well, and I know that he can't stand all of the explanations that try to explain the Shoah happened because of X, Y, because of the following sins that the Jewish people have committed. But Professor Lasker argued in this article that there isn't something that is really all that different in offering explanations of that nature. When you compare them from a philosophical perspective, when you see other explanations that have been offered previously in Jewish history and Jewish literature, they aren't out of whack with what was going on in previous generations of Jewish thinking. But I would like to make two points about this kind of comparison. First of all, I would like to point out an irony. Who are the rabbis who generally offer explanations like this? I know why this pigua took place. I know why something terrible took place. I can pinpoint the sin that led to this problem. Usually the rabbis who offer explanations like this are the same rabbis who try to teach us that it is forbidden to compare ourselves today to the great heroes of biblical times, or to Chazal, to the classical rabbis of the Talmudic times, because they were such greater people than we are. These are the same rabbis who complain when somebody offers an explanation of a biblical text that portrays some of our forefathers as perhaps having had character flaws, and they say, "How can you offer explanations like this?" And then, while complaining and asserting that we are so different from and so lesser when compared to the great heroes of biblical times and to the great rabbis of Talmudic times, they allow themselves to behave like the prophets of biblical times and like the rabbis of the Talmud. And it does not really make sense to have it both ways. Second point I'd like to make is that, in fact, within Chazal, within the classic rabbinic tradition, and within the Tanakh, there seems to be more than one approach to the question of explaining tragedies in terms of punishment for sin. I think we could all easily find examples of explanations of that nature, both within rabbinic literature and within the Bible, but I would like to suggest today that that isn't the only model that one finds in the Bible or in classical rabbinic literature. For those of you who have the source sheet that I prepared, the first text is from this morning's Haftarah from the prophet Yirmiyahu, who writes, Ni ha'isha chacham v'yavein et zot v'asher diber pi Adonai elav v'yagida alma avda ha'aretz nitztach hamidbar mibli over. Who is the wise person who can really understand why the land was destroyed, why it was burnt up? V'yomer Adonai al ozvam et torati asher natati lifnehem v'lo shamu b'koli v'lo hachuba. And God said, it is because they did not observe my Torah, they did not listen to my voice, and they did not follow it. Vayelchu acharei shirut libam, vacharei ha-be'alim asher limdu avotam. They followed the desires, the wanton desires of their own hearts, and they worshipped other gods. And that's why bad things have befallen us. So the prophet Yirmiyah is explaining the standard explanation: disaster is punishment. But in Talmudic discussion of this text, the text number 2 on the source sheet, Amar Rav Yehuda, Amar Rav, Mai dichtiv miha isha chacham v'yavin etzot v'asher diber pi Hashem elav v'yagida alma avda ha'aretz. Rav Yehuda said in the name of Rav, how do we understand this verse that's talking both about the wise man, Mi Aisha Chacham, who's the wise person who could understand this, and is also quoting God? What does this mean? According to the Talmud, it means as follows. Davar ze amru chachamim velo pershuhu, amru nevi'im velo pershuhu, ad she persho hakadosh baruch hu be'atzmo, shene'emar vayomar Adonai alozva metorati asher natati, lifnehem. In fact, the Talmud says, a wise person is not able to explain something like this. In fact, a prophet is not able to explain something like this. Only God is able to explain something like this. And so the suggestion, at least in that text, I'm not saying that's the only approach in rabbinic literature, but at least in that text, the suggestion is being made that one should be very wary of offering explanations of this nature, of what the sin is that led to punishment. This is something that God can do, but don't try it on your own at home. I often see lack of explanations for the reasons for the destruction as one of the central characteristics of the book of Echa. I know that this is a bit of an argument from silence, but I think that the silence here is very strong. The book of Echa mourns the destruction, talks about how sad it is, describes the terrible state of the Jewish people, but does not try to explain. When turning to survivors, the people who have just now survived the calamity, the author of the book of Echa tries to show sympathy, tries to describe their situation, and is not in the business of saying, this is the explanation of why you have suffered so much. It is clear to me that the author of Echa believes that sin leads to destruction, but he does not attempt in this book to identify the sin. He does not pin the rap on anybody or on anything. In fact, that theme was picked up in the keynote that were said this morning. At the end of one of the keynotes, the kina Im Tochalna Nashim Piryam by Elazar HaKalir, he writes in a kind of prose ending to a poetic piyut, he writes, "V'ruach HaKodesh lemulam mar'im." God thunders an argument towards the Jews. Masha hukram modiim. They keep talking about all the things that happened to them. They keep saying all these terrible things have happened to us. V'etasher asu lo modiim. But they don't talk about all the terrible things that they did. So Elazar HaKalir realizes that there is this problem that in the text itself there isn't an attempt to explain the sins, and he's arguing that God's upset about this. God's upset that the Jews are talking about what happened to them without trying to explain what the sin is. And in fact, both Elazar HaKalir and the poems that people recited this morning does try to identify many sins, and many people attempted to read explanations of the sins of the Jewish people back into the book of Echa. And in fact, the text number 3 on the source sheet is a text that is commonly interpreted as an explanation of why bad things happened to the Jews. Echa chapter 2 verse 20 reads, Re'e Adonai v'habita l'mi olal tako im tochalna nashim piryam olale tipuchim im yehareg b'mikdash Adonai kohen v'navi. Look, God, to whom you have done these things. Look at the fact that women in the starvation situation that existed in Jerusalem when it was under siege were reduced to eating their own children in order to stay alive. And then the last phrase in the verse reads that priests and prophets were murdered in God's temple. In the classical rabbinic literature, this text was interpreted consistently as a kind of dialogue between the Jews and God. Text number 4 is an example of this very common interpretation. It comes from the Sifra, one of the oldest collections of Midrashim. Amru alav al do'eg ben Yosef shemet vehiniach ben katan le'imo. There was a very rich man in Jerusalem named Do'eg, the son of Yosef. He died and he left a widow who had a small child. This widow was so wealthy, hayta modadehu bitfachim b'chol shana v'noteret mishkalo zahav l'shamayim. She used to measure him. This is the Midrashic explanation of the phrase olalei tipuchim. She used to measure him and see how big he was each year, and then she'd take a quantity of gold that was the same size as her baby and bring it as a present to the temple in Jerusalem every year. That's how rich she was. And then she was reduced to starvation when the city was under siege. וכשהקיפו מצודת ירושלים, when the city of Jerusalem was put under siege, טבחתו בידיו אכלתו. She killed her child with her own hand, and she ate her own child. ועליה מקונן ירמיה ואומר, ריבוני, אם תאכלנה נשים פריים עוללי טיבוכים. And that's what Yirmiyah, the author of Echa, was bemoaning, bewailing, when he said, look at the fact that women are eating their own children. Mishiva ruach hakodesh ve'omer, im yehareg v'migdash Adonai kohen v'navi, ze zecharya ben Yehoyada hakohen. Ah, the end of the verse in text 3 that reads, there are two clauses at the end of the verse. One clause that describes women eating their own children, and a second clause that describes the fact that prophets and priests are being killed in the temple. The Midrash insists on seeing these two as cause and effect. Terrible things are happening to the Jewish people. The Jewish people are reduced to eating their own children because of the starvation conditions in Jerusalem. But why is that? Because they killed their prophets and they killed their priests inside of the temple. They did. They killed their prophets. The Jews killed their prophets and their priests inside the temple. Yes, the Midrash says, yes, they did. Ze Zechariah ben Yehoyada HaKohen. Yes, just remember the story of Zechariah ben Yehoyada HaKohen. For those of you who, like me, have rusty recollections of the plot in Divrei HaYamim Bet, I'll refresh your memory that in Divrei HaYamim Bet, in 2 Chronicles chapter 24, there is the story of a prophet named Zechariah ben Yehoyada HaKohen. And so here we have a Kohen ben Navi, who actually was killed in the temple by Jews at the order of King Joash. King Joash reigned in the 9th century, more than 200 years before the destruction of the temple. Why did the Midrash take this example of something that's so far away from the destruction of the temple? Because there aren't very many examples in Tanakh of Kohanim and Nevi'im being put to death by Jews in the temple. And so the only explanation they could find is it must be that that God was arguing that the temple was destroyed because 220, 230 years ago, a holy man had been killed there. It is not a very satisfying explanation. And I would also say that it's clear that it is not the pshat, it is not the simple meaning of the verse in Echa. Many commentators explain that the verse in Echa is not to be understood in the Midrashic, according to the Midrashic explanation. I've given you one on your handout for those of you who have it, text number 5, the commentary of Yosef ibn Kaspi, a great Bible commentator from Provence from the 13th or 14th century. Yosef ibn Kaspi, he's not the only one who explains it this way, but he says it most clearly and in the smallest number of words. He says, Im yehareg al yedei Nebuchadnezzar. Both parts of the end of that verse in Echa, Im tochalna nashim piryam olalei tzipuchim, and the next clause, Im yehareg b'mikdash Hashem kohim v'navi, are describing things that were caused by the enemy and things that are not sins of the Jewish people, but they are descriptions of the disaster. The disaster included the fact that women had to eat their own children in order to stay alive, and that the enemy came into the temple and the enemy killed holy people like priests and prophets who were found in the temple. Commentators who promote Pshat often point out that there are verses in Echa, in the Book of Lamentations, that look as if they are describing the sins of the Jewish people, but on second examination, they really are not. There's a jarring verse in Echa chapter 4, verse 6, text 6 on your handout. Vayigdal avon ami mechatat sedom Hahafucha chamoraga v'lo chaluva yadayim. The avon, and we normally translate the word avon as sin, and so let's try it that way. The sin of my people was greater than the sin of Sodom that was overturned like that in one moment, and no one dallied with it. However, if you look carefully at that verse, that is also not the explanation of that verse. And the word avon, for people who have studied a little bit of biblical Hebrew, avon has many meanings to it. And one of the meanings of the word avon in biblical Hebrew is punishment. And Rabbi Yosef Kara, a student or a colleague of Rashi in northern France, writes in his commentary, Vayigdal Avon Batami, text number 7 on the source sheet, Vayigdal Avon Batami Mechatat Sodom, Klomar, Yoter Haita Nikmata Minikmat Sodom. The punishment, the vengeance that was brought upon the Jewish people was even worse than the vengeance that was brought on Sodom. And he goes on to explain that it's true that Sodom was entirely destroyed, but the enemies did not come and mock the people and take them as slaves and in other ways degrade and debase their victims. Sodom died at the hands of God, and it died quickly. And the Jewish people suffered in a long and difficult type of suffering. So I think it is clear that the book of Echa is trying to avoid giving explanations of what the sins of the Jewish people are. It's also interesting to note that the Midrashic tradition is trying to find hints of these sins, even though the book of Echa is trying to avoid this. So I would argue that both of these approaches are traditional Jewish approaches. For the rest of today's lecture, I would like to concentrate on the message that the Tanakh gives us about the first exile of the Jewish people. The exile of the Jewish people, or if you prefer, the exile of the family of our father Yaakov to Egypt. Our first reaction might be to think that there is almost nothing new to say about this topic, since we talk about it every year at the Seder. We talk about the enslavement and the exodus from Egypt, and we try to talk about what the message of that text might be. This last year when I was in Israel, I had the privilege of hearing a brilliant lecture from Professor Uriel Simon of Bar-Ilan University, in my opinion, one of the leading Bible scholars in the world today. And his lecture was entitled, What Would the Haggadah Look Like If It Had Been Based on the Tanakh Instead of Being Based on Rabbinic Literature? And much of what I'm going to say in the next few minutes is based on things that I learned from Professor Simon's lecture. The Haggadah that we all know so well is based on Chazal's understanding of the meaning of diaspora and the meaning of redemption. But the exile in Egypt, the enslavement in Egypt, the disasters that befell the Jewish people when they were in Egypt is a key theme in Tanakh also. What does the Tanakh say about that enslavement and what it is that we are supposed to learn from that disaster, from that enslavement? It turns out that actually the Tanakh has quite a bit to say about this. And perhaps I'll just make an aside methodological comment. I strongly feel that you don't have to be a Karaite in order to be interested in what the Tanakh says, even if there is a rabbinic tradition of understanding understanding the meaning of the enslavement in Egypt. I think it is still worthwhile for Jews to look at the pshat, to look at the plain meaning, the simple meaning of the biblical text, and see what meaning the Tanakh itself is trying to ascribe to the enslavement in Egypt. First of all, it is crucial to notice what the Tanakh does not say. Again, another argument for the silence, admittedly, it does not say that the exile in Egypt was punishment for anything at all. I don't have the the kind of expertise in rabbinic literature to make the claim that I would really like to make right now. But I don't remember in classical rabbinic literature a text that tries to explain that the reason that the Jews were enslaved in Egypt was because of sins that they committed. I think I could safely say that doesn't appear in the Tanakh anywhere. I don't think it appears in classical rabbinic literature. The first place where I have found it, maybe there are one or two classical rabbinic sources I haven't. Don't have expertise in everything. The first text that I know of that makes this claim is in the 13th century, Ramban in his Torah commentary, in a fascinating, although not totally convincing, explanation of what the sin was that led to the exile in Egypt. Those of you who have a source sheet, it's source number 8. Ramban writes in his commentary to Genesis chapter 12, Da ki Avraham Avinu chata chet gadol bishgaga. Shehivi ishto hatzadeket v'michshol avon mipnei pachado pen yaharguhu. Know that our father Abraham committed a great sin when he brought his wife into a dangerous situation, when he brought her into Egypt and claimed that she was his sister. And she could have been... Many terrible things could have happened to her because of this lie that he told. He should have just trusted God instead of coming up with this story that his wife was his sister. God is capable of providing salvation. Gam yitziyato min ha'aretz shenitztava aleha bitzchila mipnei ha'ra'av avon asher chet. And in fact, the very fact that he didn't trust in God, that he left the land, he just arrived in the land in the beginning of chapter 12, and then immediately he leaves the land, that also was a sin. Va'al ha-ma'aseh hazeh nigzar al zaro ha-galut ve'eretz Mitzrayim biyad paro. And that is why the Jewish people suffered in Egypt and were enslaved in Egypt, because of the sin of Avraham, who took his wife to Egypt, and then lied when he was there in Egypt, and he shouldn't have done either of those things. And in a fitting way, God punished the Jewish people by enslaving them in Egypt, which was the place where Abraham had committed the sin of lying about his wife and not trusting sufficiently in God. An interesting, I said, fascinating, although not all that convincing explanation of the sin, but that's not what the Bible itself says. What does the Bible say about our experience in Egypt? Why were we enslaved in Egypt? Text number 9 on the source sheet, Ve'etchem lakach Adonai, Vayotzi etchem mikur habarzel mimitzrayim liot lo la'am nachala kayom hazeh. God took you. He took you out of that iron smelter in Egypt. A very interesting image. Egypt as an iron, a kur barzel, to be his people as you are today. What is the meaning of the image of saying that Egypt was like an iron smelter? An iron smelter is, of course, very hot. And so there are some midrashim that try to see this image also as a metaphor for an instrument of punishment or torture. On your source sheet here, both source number 10 talks about even God, to save time, I'll just summarize the text, that when God put his hand into this iron smelter to bring us out of the iron smelter, we suffered, and it was as if God was suffering too. So in other words, the image is an extremely hot, an unpleasant place, a place where nobody would want to be, neither us nor God. And it was that's what's meant by a kur barzel. Let's read maybe text number 11 from the source sheet. Rabbi Akiva Omer, Isplatorim Shel Paro. Rabbi Akiva said, Paro's executioners, a word from a Latin source, Hayu machnikim et Yisrael bekirot shel batim uvena levenim, vayu tzoakim mitoch kirot habayit, והקדוש ברוך הוא שומע צעקתם. Paro's executioners took the Jewish babies and they put them inside the buildings that were being built as part of the walls, and they were screaming, they were being put to death this way. God heard their cry, Shene Emar Vaishma Elohim et Tzaakatam. God heard them crying. Ve'od shayu sorfim et b'neihem ha-bechorim b'chur ha-esh. I think a play on words here. The Kur ha-barzel is a play on the word b'chor, that they would take the firstborn of the Israelites and they burned these babies, the firstborn babies of the Israelites. And that's the meaning of the verse, Etchem lakach Adonai vayotzi etchem mikur habarzel. That's what it means when it said that God took us out of the iron smelter. A moving image of the suffering of the Jewish people in Egypt. But again, I would argue that that is not the pshat explanation of the text. And that is not the pshat explanation of the image of what an iron smelter is. I'm not a big expert in this, but as best I understand, you put iron into a smelter not to punish the iron, but to refine it and to improve it. Yes, it's hot, and perhaps it's uncomfortable, but the major purpose is to make things better than they were before. Rav Ephraim Lunshitz in 16th century Poland, in his commentary on the Torah, Kli Yikar, explains in text number 12 on the source sheet, that Chem lakach mikur habarzel, what does it mean to say that God took us out of the iron smelter? What's a kur habarzel? Hamenakeh hakesef mikol sigu psolet adjienaki vizach barakach hama. An iron smelter is a place where you put the silver in order to get refine it, and in order to get the impurities out of it, in order so that it'll be shiny and beautiful and wonderful and be the way you want it to be. That's the image of this Kur HaBarzel. It's a place that makes something better than it was before. Kach, Rav Ephraim Lunshitz explains, Kach nizdakech omer shelachem v'inui Mitzrayim ad shanasa barur kashemesh. What happened to the Jewish people when they were in Egypt? They were made better. Their material was refined until they become as bright as the sun. That's what the experience of the enslavement in Egypt, the first great disaster of the Jewish people, that's how the Tanakh explains it, according to Rav Ephraim Lunshitz, and I think that he's right. What did the Jews accomplish? How were we made better by our experience in Egypt? One of the many things I learned from my father-in-law, Zichrono Livracha, who some of you in this room knew, was one of his sayings was that from every teacher you have in the world, you can learn, no matter who the teacher is. You can either learn how to be, or you can learn how not to be. And that's one of the explanations that the Torah gives of what it is that we learn from our experience in Egypt. Text number 13 says that the Torah tells us, "Kemase eretz Mitzrayim asher yishavtem ba lo ta'asu." You people were in Egypt. You know how bad it was there in Egypt. Don't be like the Egyptians. And that's part of the lesson that the Jewish people were supposed to learn from our experience in Egypt, was not to be like the Egyptians. Often that can be the greatest lesson. A person sees a corrupt society and decides to make all efforts not to be like that corrupt society. But that is hardly all that the Bible says about our enslavement in Egypt and what we, the Jewish people, are supposed to learn from the enslavement in Egypt. In the second version of the Ten Commandments, in Sefer Dvarim, text number 14 on your source sheet, we have the explanation of why it is we are supposed to observe the Shabbat. Just start reading in verse Yud Gimel there. V'yom ha-shvi'i Shabbat l'Adonai lecha lo ta'aseh chom lecha ata u'mincha u'vitecha avdecha v'amadcha v'shorcha v'chamorcha v'chol be'emtecha v'gercha asher v'sharecha lema'an yanuach avdecha v'amadcha kamocha. Everyone must rest on the Shabbat. Everyone in your family, all of your slaves. And the slaves are mentioned twice in the verse. Ata uvincha uvitecha v'avdecha v'amatecha. your children and the slaves and the animals. And why? Leman yanuach avdecha va'amatcha kamocha. Because it's really crucial that the slaves get to rest just as you rest. V'zacharta ki eved hayita ve'eretz Mitzrayim. And you know, and that's why you had that experience of being in Egypt. Because you're supposed to remember what it was like to be a slave when you were in Egypt. You were a slave, God took you out of there. That's why God told you to observe Shabbat. Now, the causation of the logic here between verse Yud Gimel and verse Yud Dal, verse 13 and verse 14, isn't entirely spelled out. But to me, it looks like the Torah is saying that we have to remember that slaves sometimes get freed and that the tables sometimes get turned. You learned that in Egypt. You were slaves, and then you stopped being slaves. So remember that when you have your own slaves or servants or people under your control, beware that the same thing could happen to you again if you do not let your servants and your slaves rest as you rest. It is not only slaves whom the Torah tells us that we are to treat better because of our experience in Egypt. Text number 15 says to us, Ger lo tzoneh velo tilchatenu, do not cheat or oppress the ger, ki gerim heyitem ve'eretz Mitzrayim, because you were a ger, you were a stranger in the land of Egypt. And while I know that in the halachic literature there is discussion, and it's generally understood in the halachic literature that the ger that is being referred to, lahalacha, in this verse, is the ger tzedek. From a pshat point of view, it just doesn't work. We were not gerei tzedek. We were not proselytes. We were not converts to the Egyptian religion when we were in Egypt. So when it says here, do not cheat or oppress the ger, that because you were once a ger in the land of Egypt, it means a stranger on the pshat level. I'm not, God forbid, suggesting changing the halakha, but the message of the text on the pshat level is that we have to remember that we were strangers, and we have to be nice to strangers because of that. And if we assume, and I think it's reasonable to assume that verse 20 here, Kaf, is connected also with the next three verses, then I think the message gets expanded even more. Kol amana v'yatom lo ta'anun. And not only is it the ger, the stranger, whom you shouldn't take advantage of, you shouldn't take advantage of the widow or the orphan either. Imane ta'aneo tokim tza'ok yitzake lai shamoa eshma tza'akato. Because if you take advantage of them, all they have to do is cry out, and I'll hear them. I will get angry at you. I will kill you. If you take advantage of widows and orphans, I will, as Rashbam explains the logic of this verse, it is measure for measure. If you do something like this to widows and orphans, they will call out, and your wives will become widows, and your children will become orphans, because I will kill you. It seems that the text is saying that we learned from our sojourn in Egypt that God listens to the cry of the oppressed, because he listened to us. That's what we learned by being in the situation of being oppressed, and then calling out to God, and then having God answer us. We learned that God does that. And he will listen to the cry of the widow and the orphan, and he will treat us the way he treated the Egyptians if we oppress the powerless in our society. Sometimes the argument of the Torah about what it is that we were supposed to learn from our stay in Egypt, from our enslavement in Egypt, is phrased not in a threatening manner, but rather in a suggestion that our psychological sensitivity was enhanced, or at least it should have been enhanced, by the years of our enslavement in Egypt. Text number 16 says, Ger lo tilchatz, v'atem yedatem et nefesh ha-ger, ki gerim heitem be'eretz Mitzrayim. That we are not allowed to oppress the stranger because we understand what it means. Atem yedatem et nefesh ager. We understand what it means to be a ger. And shockingly, the Torah teaches us that what the enslavement in Egypt should have taught us is not hate, but love. Va'ahavtem et hager, the suggestion that we should even be loving the stranger, kigerim ha'item be'eretz Mitzrayim. And again, the end of that verse, I know that the operative halachic explanation is that the ger of this verse is the convert, and on a halachic level, there's no question that this is a specific mitzvah to love the convert. But on the pshat level, this verse is definitely saying that we have to have love for the stranger because we know what it is like to be a stranger in a strange land. Because of time, I'm going to skip over a small number of sources here on the source sheet. You can read them themselves. They're very clear, and they're further examples of the things that we were supposed to learn to be nice to. That so many areas of a halakha are based on the assumption, because we know what it means to be the underdog, because we know what it means to be the oppressed, we have a responsibility to treat the underdog and to treat the oppressed in a better way. And text number 18, 19, 20 on the source sheet all discuss this. I'll skip down to text number 21, which addresses the thorny question of, this is telling us what we should think. All the texts until now have told us what we should think about underdogs. We were once underdogs. We know what it's like not to be treated nicely. And so the lesson for us is that we should treat people, if we're in a position of power, we should treat people below us in a fine way. But what should be our attitude towards the people who oppressed us? According to the Tanakh, what are we supposed to think of the people who enslaved us? As we know from history and from the Haggadah, the oppression and the enslavement of the Jews in Egypt was sadly not a one-time event. It was a paradigm. It was a model for further enslavements of the Jews over the years. Behold, dor vador omdim aleinu l'chaloteinu. The Haggadah teaches us, the rabbis teach us. But what is supposed to be our attitude towards those who oppress us? Amazingly, the Torah tells us in text number 21, Lo tita'ev adomi ki achichahu, lo tita'ev mitzri ki ger hayita be'arzo. We are not allowed to despise an Edomite because they are mishpocha, they're our family. And we're not allowed to despise an Egyptian because we were strangers in their land. Amazing. That's the memory that we're supposed to take away from our experience in Egypt, was that we were strangers in the land of Israel, land of Egypt. They took us in. There wasn't enough food in Canaan, and they took us in, and they let us live there for a while. What about the rest of the story? This is what the Torah tells us we should be learning from an attitudinal point of view. What should be our attitude towards the Egyptians? That's the attitude. Rashi puts it very, puts it starkly. Lo tita'ev mitzri mikol vakol afal pi shezarku zechorechem la'yeor. I know that they took your babies and they threw them in the Nile. I know that. Rashi's addressing the tension that we all feel when we read this text. He's saying, yes, I know that they did that. Matam, and why should I not despise them? Shehayu lachem achsanya b'sha'at hadchak. Because they provided us with a place to live when we didn't have another place to live. Ramban says that same thought in text number 23 on your handout. Hamitzrim hirchikam shlosha dorot mipnei risham asher asu imanu ra'ot rabot v'tzarot. It's true that there are some sanctions taken against the Egyptians because they did bad things to us. Aval lo yita'ev otam le'olam. But this feeling of despising them, it cannot last forever. Why? They took us in at a difficult time. They treated our father Yaakov nicely. They made a Jewish boy into the viceroy of Egypt. We have to remember that. That should be the lasting memory that we have, and that should be our attitude towards Egyptians. We have to learn from our exile to have respect for those people who gave us shelter in exile, even if they ended up becoming the ones who threw our babies into the Nile and killed them. That's the lesson that we are supposed to learn from the exile in Egypt. That was the Kor HaBarzel. That's what we learned from the smelter that we were. It was an unpleasant experience being in Egypt. But the lesson that we were supposed to learn, according to the plain meaning of Scripture, according to the Pshat, is a lesson about how we treat the people whom we control these days, in whatever situation we might have control over people, and the attitude that we should have to the people who actually oppressed us. Let us always bear this text in mind when we think about what our attitude should be to various countries throughout the world, without naming any, that persecuted Jews, but also at other periods in history provided shelter for Jewish communities. The Torah commands us to remember the paradigm of Egypt and to remember the shelter that was provided by the Egyptians, not to remember, there's no mitzvah that I know that says remember that the Egyptians were murderers. There's a mitzvah to remember that the Egyptians took us in when nobody else would take us in and provided us with something to eat. With the 5 minutes that are left to me, I would like to conclude with yet another theory about the purpose of Galut. A surprising theory that was offered by Rav Avraham Yitzchak HaKohen Kuk, the first chief rabbi of Israel. Rav Kuk, who is often identified with a hardline attitude towards the issue of Jewish interaction with our non-Jewish neighbors, once offered a very novel explanation unconnected with reward and punishment of the purpose of the exile of the Jewish people. Rav Kook wrote this text in the late 20s or the early 30s of the 20th century, before the rise of Nazism, in a period when many people, including Rav Kook, were convinced that the modern world was a much better place to live than it had been for a number of millennia. Rav Kook was a big believer in progress. It's always interesting to think, what would Rav Kook have written if he had lived through the Shoah? But in the period in which he lived, part of the spirit, the cultural spirit of the world, was a belief that the world was becoming better, and Rav Kook was part of that belief. I'll read the text in Hebrew and in English. I divided it up into three little sections here. Section 24. Azavnu et ha-politika ha-olamit me'ones she'yesh bo ratzon penimi ad asher yavo et me'ushara she'yeh efshar lenahel mamlacha b'lo risha u'barbariyut. Zehu hazman she'anu mekavim muvan hadavar she'kedei lehagshimo anachnu tzrichim lishtamesh b'chochotenu kulam, לשתמש בכל האמצעים שהזמן מביא, אבל האיחור הוא איחור מוכרח. בחלה נפשנו בחטאים האיומים של הנהגת ממלכה בעת רעה. Now, in English translation, we were coerced from the stage of world politics because of a deep reason. Until happier times would come, and we would be able to run a sovereign state without evil and without barbarism. This is the time that we have been awaiting. It was necessary for the Jews to be in Galut. So I don't think the Rav Kook would deny the punishment aspect, but the other explanation is that it was a good time not to be a sovereign state. From the year 70 of the Common Era till Rav Kook's days, Rav Kook says, Baruch Hashem that we weren't a sovereign state, because we would have had to be really barbaric to be a sovereign state in those days. This is the time that we have been awaiting, when it would be possible to have a sovereign state that isn't barbaric, of course, in order to bring it to fruition, we will have to use all of our powers and use whatever means the times require. But the delay was a necessary delay, says Rav Kook. Our souls are disgusted by the terrible sins involved in running a nation in evil times. It was all part of a divine plan, according to Rav Kook, to remove the Jews from the realm of sovereignty during those years when we would have had to have been very barbaric had we been in the realm of sovereignty. Rav Kook, the optimist of the late 20s or early 30s, writes number 25, Hine higia hazman karov ma'od. The time is coming very soon. This is the world that we are in right now. Lanu kvar yeh efshar lenahel mamlachtenu al yesodot hatov, hachochma, hayosher, vehahara ha'elohit haberura. We will now be able to conduct our state on the foundations of goodness, wisdom, honesty, and clear divine enlightenment. And his final line of Rav Kook's text, line 26, Ein hadavar kedai li Yaakov la'asok b'mamlacha be'et shehi tzricha liyot damim malea be'et shetova'at kisharon shel risha. It is not worthwhile for the Jewish people to be involved with running a sovereign state at a time when that state has to be filled with the spilling of blood, at a time when it requires agility at evil in order to run a state. So I hope that I have proved to your satisfaction that the model of the punishment explanation for exile and for enslavement is not the only model that exists in rabbinic literature and in the Tanakh. The idea that enslavement and exile can be learning experiences seems to be the major message of the Torah, at least when the Torah is dealing with the first exile of the Jewish people, the exile from Egypt. And the idea of a Jewish thinker like Rav Kook, that some aspects of the exile of the Jewish people were beneficial to us in order to allow us to be an Am Kadosh, in order to allow us to be a holy people and not to have to sink down to the level of other nations of the world.